Health Policy Committee, meeting open March 14, 2005. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 298. And is there any discussion? I close the public hearing on 298. I'd like to open a work session on 298. I have the dash one amendments that I just received, and I would like to give it to our committee members. Basically, it prohibits state from imposing a period of time as being uninsured as a condition of eligibility for the medical assistance program, FEOP, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or State Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, if the person or dependents are otherwise eligible for the program were terminated from a group health policy insurance policy at the time of death or when divorced or legally separated from the policy certificate holder, and the application for services is within 6 months preceding the date of the application. It applies to applications on or after the effective date of the program. Is there any discussion?
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 298-314-05.
Senator Courtney has moved the dash one amendments. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
I move Senate Bill 298 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senate Bill 298 has been passed to the floor as amended with a due pass. Now, SCR 7, but I hear that the main proponent of SCR 7 is not here. Oh, the carrier of the bill will be me. No. Okay, let's just move SCR 7 to the bottom in case someone comes, and let's go into Senate Bill 697. Okay, I'll close the SCR 7 public hearing and I'll open a work session on 697. And Marshall, do you want to be the first to testify? Is that the
work session?
Nobody wants to work session.
Public hearing. This is a public hearing on Senate Bill 697.
Thank you.
I just got here on time and we started.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Marshall Koba, representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. With me today are Ted Rubeck from OHSU and Scott Beyer, who's the current president of the society. And I'll have them make our testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, allowing us to bring 697 to your attention and the committee's attention. In 2001, the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants went
Please state your name.
I'm sorry, I'm Scott Beyer. I'm the president of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. My apologies. In 2001, the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants brought two bills to the legislature at that time. The first bill had to deal with allowing a PA to have up to four supervising physicians and to allow a supervising physician to have up to four PAs. And this went through with a sunset clause that would expire in January of this year. And at this time, we were asking to have that sunset clause removed. The second part of 697 has to do with a separate bill that came in 2001, and that had to allow a PA to be able to work in a satellite office or an office that was not the office of the regular practice of the physician. And again, that was placed with the sunset clause. And again, we are asking to have that sunset clause removed. And so we combined those two topics in this bill, 697. And we have an amendment that on page 2 of the printed bill, if we can restore lines 17 through 22, which were adversely removed, and that has to do with PAs being involved with the Pain Commission, and that we presented to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not new.
Does anyone else want to say anything? Do you know of any opposition to this bill?
No, we do not.
Any discussion? Seeing none, I'd like to open a work session on... Oh, wait. I have Karen Whitaker. Okay. No further discussion. Close the work session. Public hearing on Senate Bill 697 and open a work session on Senate Bill 697.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 697-310-05.
Senator Courtney has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 697. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 697 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved Senate Bill 697 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections or any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator George.
The amendments, I cannot find them. So.
Oh, they should be in your packet. And basically, on page 2, it's of the printed bill, it restores lines 17 through 22, which was done in error of the original statute. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Curtis?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Monahan?
Aye. Senate Bill 697 passed with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Motion passed. And the carrier?
I'll carry.
Good. Great. Senator Morissette will carry the bill. Okay. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 697 and open a work session on Senate Bill 698. I open a public hearing on 698. Moving so fast. Okay. Marshall Koba.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, Marshall Koba representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants on Senate Bill 698. Since this bill was posted last week, there's been a number of discussions, and I think they just culminated out in the hall with a number of our colleagues in the healthcare profession, EMTs and ambulance service providers and others. I'll leave it up to the chair, but there may be a need for us to have some further discussions out in the hall to help clarify some of the issues around this, and if we're more than happy to do that, if that would be the wish of the committee. And I think that from what I can tell, everyone in the hall is interested in getting to the same point, which is clarifying the situation, but some of these discussions are relatively new. With me again is Scott Beyer, the president, and Ted Ruback, and Scott could give a brief overview, I think, of where it is that we want to get to, and I'll leave it up to you if we should have that hall discussion. Thank you.
Madam Chair, again, my name is Scott Beyer. I'm the president of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. And we bring to you 698, Senate bill. And what the reason that we brought this bill forward is that we have a number of PAs who are working in specifically rural areas brought up the situation was the idea that there was a need for some supervision of EMTs in that area. And the PAs had expressed to us as an organization that they were informed that they did not have the ability to do that supervisory role. And so that brought our organization forward to creating this bill that would allow them to be able to do that. There's an understanding that as a physician assistant, we have to work with a PA physician team. So there's always a physician that's doing our supervision, and that's done through the Board of Medical Examiners. So if a PA was given the ability to do the supervisory role, what would occur would be that there'd still be a physician involved, but it would allow that PA in that area to work with that. Since we've came to a hearing date, a number of people have come to us and spoken with us about ways that we can work around this to make this more efficient for everybody, and that is our goal, is to make this work for everybody. So we would like the ability to come and work with these individuals and then come back to you if you wish and present this as a bill that will solve the problems for all.
Yes, Senator Morstead.
I support the bill and the concept. What do you mean of there would still be a physician involved if you're out in the country and there's an accident and you're working with the EMTs? There's no physician within miles. I guess involved because you were working under the direction of. He doesn't have to be there at the time. Is that right?
That's correct, Senator Morissette. We have to have some type of ability of communication that's required by our state statutes. So that PA would have the ability electronically or otherwise to communicate with the physician if there was a question that was beyond their scope, but they do not physically have to be there.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess you're establishing a chain of command, so to speak, and I understand the delicacy of working together as much as possible, which is what you're doing. In the best case scenario, you would be able to use a cell phone and call a physician and maybe describe a situation or whatever and get some direction. But without that, I guess you would be going on the general chain of command that this bill would establish. Is that correct?
That would be correct.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
Any further discussion? Okay. So, Ted?
No.
Okay. No. And, all right. I'd like to call then Karen Whitaker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of OHSU's Center for Rural Health, which contains the Oregon Office of Rural Health, that is a state agency and charged with looking after the health care of rural Oregonians. We're very interested in Senate Bill 698 and certainly support the concept of PAs being able to supervise EMTs in the field. There are some counties in Oregon that only have PAs. There are no physicians in those counties, and in fact PAs are the only source of care, allowing them to exchange information and recommend treatment options to EMTs simply makes sense. The decline in numbers of rural physicians willing to supervise PAs and nurse practitioners is also true in the case of rural EMTs, and I know of several PAs who teach EMT classes, but current law, according to my understanding, restricts their ability to supervise an EMT in the field. We know that response time is longer, transport time is longer, and death rates are higher when traffic accidents occur in very rural parts of the state. Passage of 698 could help to improve those statistics. And I understand there is a difference of opinion on whether or not the legislation is necessary, is what I'm hearing behind me and in front of me. So we would certainly be interested in hearing what people are willing to work out on this bill, but we definitely support the concept.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Nancy Heim, Sean Baird, and Dave Lapoff.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association. Our members provide 911 emergency ambulance service throughout the state. And we are here today. We came in opposition to Senate Bill 698, but we started initial discussions out in the hall with the physician assistants, and we're happy to continue those discussions. There are different ways in which physicians work with ambulance service providers and EMTs, and we think the issue here can be addressed probably without a change in statute. With me today are, first of all, Sean Baird, who is past president of our association and current legislative chair. He serves on the state's Emergency Medical Services Advisory Committee. He is co-owner of Woodburn Ambulance and also works in the field as a paramedic. And he chairs his area trauma advisory board. And also Dave Lapoff, who is past president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. And it is volunteer agencies which provide emergency medical services throughout most of rural Oregon. And he represents those interests in our association. He also serves on the Board of Medical Examiners Emergency Medical Technicians Advisory Committee. His committee and our association discussed this bill on Friday in separate meetings, and a number of concerns were raised, and they are here today to explain those concerns to you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Dave Lapoff is my name. I'm a volunteer lieutenant with the Kaiser Fire District, as well as past president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters, as Nan has said. When this legislation first came to our awareness, I contacted a number of our members who are volunteer firefighter and EMS providers in the rural parts of the state, over the halfway Oxbow area, Baker City, Vail, and Ontario. And none of the individuals I spoke to voiced any concern. And generally, our membership is pretty good about contacting us when they have an issue, and then we will either help them broker it to the State Ambulance Association, if they're a member of that group, or a member of the Oregon Fire Medical Administrators Group, which is a subcommittee of the Oregon Fire Chiefs. So between our four associations, we pretty much can represent everybody on an EMS issue. One of the biggest hurdles with our membership is chain of command. And while I understand that we all like to freelance, and that's not an exceptionally bad thing at times, when it comes to medical care, it's paramount that we have a really clear chain of command. When the provider goes out there and they need to call back for medical direction, if they're calling an urgent care clinic that has a physician's assistant or a PA, they can maybe field some of that information, but when it comes time to give medications or to make the determination to go to a higher level center, whether they need to go to the hospital in Baker City, have the helicopter program transport them to a level one or level two trauma center, we believe, and our membership does, that we've talked to, believes that responsibility falls on a physician. They have the liability insurance, they have the expertise and the training to be able to make those calls in the field. So we see that as a vital piece to the whole EMS structure of the community. There needs to be consistency. Every agency has a supervising physician, and that person writes their standing orders, does quality assurance on their charts, and then also meets with them and troubleshoots any problems they've had or helps them have better education to do better performance in the field. To interrupt that consistency and have one person overseeing all that seems to degrade the situation. So I wanted to keep my comments brief and certainly would answer any questions. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. That implies then that you do have instant and maybe constant ability to communicate with the physician.
Yes, Senator Morissette. The way it works is an ambulance with first responders or EMT basics will go out into the field, start transport or treatment of a patient, and maybe they will contact a intermediate ambulance and advanced life support ambulance and do a transfer to transfer the patient from a basic life support level to an ALS or advanced life support level. And it, within that communication, it'll be either cell phones or radios with radio technology nowadays and cell phone capability. You're almost ever outside of communication with the hospital. Mm-hmm. Some providers will have a clinic within their jurisdiction that is staffed by a physician's assistant or PA. But the majority of times, these patients are going to a hospital, and they will call the hospital directly. And it doesn't have to be their doctor that they're talking to. It just needs to be an ER doc. The same same scenario takes place here in Salem. Mm-hmm. At Kaiser, if we're transporting a patient into the city of Salem, we will call the ER and speak to the doctor to get approval for certain medications or ask them about certain treatments that our paramedics can't troubleshoot on their own in the field.
But what if you're in a situation in which, say, there is a physician's assistant right there, it's their patient, and they feel it in the best interest of the patient to go administer some form of medication, et cetera, that wouldn't be under your standing orders, or I'm not sure if that...
Right, that's good terminology.
Okay. And you know, PA, physician assistants do have appropriate training. So you're saying you would not listen to a physician's assistant?
No, Madam Chair.
In that case?
I'm going to defer here to Sean Baird here in a minute. I just want to make sure I understand the question correctly, that if we're out on, an accident scene and a physician's assistant is there on scene with us...
Yes, happens to be
then
there.
That would be different because, well, I guess I would have to defer to Sean. If it was an EMT basic, then we would defer to, or an intermediate, defer to the physician's assistant because they're higher level care. Now, whether a paramedic would necessarily do that, I'm not sure, because paramedics and physician's assistants on a pre-hospital level are equal, as far as my opinion goes. But I'd like to defer to Sean to answer that, if I may.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sean Baird with Woodburn Ambulance Service. Our association discussed this fairly extensively, as well as I'm a member of the State Emergency Medical Services Advisory Committee to DHS, and we discussed that fairly extensively just last week also. Both groups had the same concerns with the bill. The primary one being that none of us were aware of there being any sort of problem that required this sort of fix. Every ambulance provider in the state of Oregon currently has a licensed physician as a medical director, and there has not been a time in recent memory, and I've been in this field for about a little over 15 years, where a service has not been able to obtain those services. And that's for the medical director role, which Senate Bill 698 addresses. And that's an administrative role. The bill addresses whether or not the person who writes the written standing orders that you work on when you're not in contact with any medical provider, when you're just sort of running a call and doing your thing, so to speak, and those are all done under standing order. That's what this bill deals with. There's a second situation, which is the one I think that your question referred to, which is on an immediate situation, intervening in a specific patient care scenario, who provides direction and under what circumstances would it be someone, a physician or a PA or whatever. Unfortunately, this bill... And this is one of the reasons we thought we need to probably talk some more with each other to figure out exactly what needs to be addressed. This bill doesn't really deal with that situation because those online medical control is addressed in several ways under Oregon administrative rule and under statute, but not this statute. So we need to kind of sort that out. But in a nutshell, the other thing about there's a medical director for every service. Well, there are physicians in every single ER in the state of Oregon that's practicing, certified as an emergency room. And the way our emergency medical service system has been built from the ground up for over the last 30 years has been hand-in-hand with EMS providers working under the strength and guidance of physicians who have an expertise in providing emergency care. They're available to help write the standing orders. They're also available for immediate consultation in any ER. So even if you're not going to transport to that ER, for example, in my area of practicing in Woodburn, Mount Angel, Silverton, we may have contact with the patient and we're trying to decide the best course of action. We can contact the ER physician on duty in Silverton and talk through the situation with them and receive guidance, regardless of whether we're actually going to transport there or not. And but their expertise is available all the time. And each area of the state has what is the de facto regional ER for that area. It may not be within 5 miles, but with that, the actual distance is kind of irrelevant because you're doing a consultation over the phone. Anyway, so as we had mentioned earlier, we'd like to talk with the PA's group and figure out exactly what the issue they're driving at is and see where we need to go with it. But I think it's a little premature to just move ahead with this particular proposal.
Senator George.
Thanks, Sean. A couple of questions I have is right in the middle of your presentation, you start off by describing the bill 698, and then you make the statement, we are not aware of any emergency ambulance service in the entire state that has been unable to obtain services of a licensed physician to be the medical director. Coupling that with the idea of liability for a liability insurance available to PA, how would you, if this bill passed, how would you be assured that, in other words, would you change anything that you're normally doing because you have that person on staff who's that doctor who's qualified? And would you take a risk if you didn't know whether that PA was fully covered with liability insurance?
Well, I can say, as the owner of an ambulance service, I wouldn't, because my insurance company requires that I have a licensed medical doctor or DO be our supervising physician. So we certainly wouldn't be moving in that direction.
Interesting. Can I get a clarification? So you're saying right now your carrier is saying you can only you're only authorized with a liability issue to receive instruction from this kind of a group?
Yes, I have to provide them with a copy of their state license.
Does that go the same for nurse practitioners?
No, we're only the only provider that we're allowed to have as a medical director right now is an MD or DO.
Thank you.
Well, one further point. I think you've already said it, and that person is always a doctor in an emergency room. Is that what you're saying?
The not necessarily the medical director for the service, that's the administrator that oversees your written standing orders, but for online or immediate consultation, you can always contact the on-duty ER physician at any ER within the state. So they're kind of two distinct categories. There's the one that's more a part of your admin team, and then there's the on-duty doctors that we do for consult on specific patients.
Okay, follow up, please. Well, in terms of your insurance, are they requiring you to make your emergency contact with an emergency room doc? Is that part of the insurance, or do they not differentiate?
They don't really get into that level of operations, other than they require the medical director to set a protocol for you to follow. Our protocols say you'll have to call. I mean, in a sense, they do what you're saying, that our doctor, who's our medical director, then says, if you want to consult on a patient, you need to call a hospital ER and talk with the ER physician.
Any other discussion? Thank you. John, is it Progastis?
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Senate. My name is John Progastis. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon State Paramedic Association. We are the oldest EMT and paramedic group in the state of Oregon. We've been down to testify for almost 25 years on bills. I'm here today to oppose 698. We have concerns. You've heard some of them from our colleagues. Rather than restate what has happened, perhaps I can give you a short overview of how we work every day, where this bill comes in, and what we'd like to do. In the 70s, you probably remember the show Emergency, where Johnny and Roy were driving around in their new rescue rig. And every time they saw a patient, they had to call on the radio to the hospital and ask for advice. We haven't had that in Oregon for almost 20 years now. We have standing orders with specific instructions for care in almost every condition that we would normally see with drugs and dosages. What we're talking about here is online medical direction for a patient that we may see in the field that is somehow outside of our normal training, and we're calling to find out what is in the patient's best interest. So we're not calling every patient, and we're not specifically talking about the report that we give to the hospital as we come in, but we're talking about patients that have unusual medical problems. This bill, unfortunately, doesn't address any of the ideas of online medical control. It's actually carried in another chapter, 677, and not this, not as, I think this is 682 or 3. The other problem that we have with the bill is that there's no language within the bill that talks about online medical control. It does create four things that are new in statute, none of which have to do with online medical control. It does, in the definitions, create a title and a position for a physician assistant. It allows the Board of the State Health Division, EMS and Trauma Service Office, to discipline me as a paramedic for not having standing orders. It requires the physician assistants to be under the Board of Medical Examiners in their role as defined by the Board of Medical Examiners for emergency medical services. And it prohibits both our group as paramedics and EMTs and what would be the physician assistance group to allow people to practice without orders. That's all. And so we would like to meet with the physician assistance group and our peers. I'm sure that there's a way we can do this. I suspect that it's already allowed in the administrative rules. We heard about this bill Saturday, so we haven't had a lot of talk back and forth amongst ourselves. Whether this bill is necessary or not, we're going to find out. But we're committed to making the system better in Oregon. We just don't think that this is the one. So I'd be happy to answer questions, and I've given you my testimony. So,
any discussion? Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
There are two letters from Ritu Sani, who's a physician from Lake Oswego, and Denise Garb, president of the Oregon Fire Medical Administrators Association, both sent letters in opposition for our files. So at this point in time, I would like the two parties to get together, Marshall, Ted, and Scott, with Nan and the fire, the paramedics, and see what can be done. Okay? I'd like to close the public hearing on 698. And she's here. Yeah. And I'd like to open a public hearing on SCR 7, Joe Bell. And Lita.
Thank you. you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill, or SCR 7. For the record, I'm Joe Bell, and I'm Director of Legislative Support Services for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And one of my focus areas for my job is healthcare workforce development and retention. You've already heard our testimony on February 25th about the healthcare workforce shortages in Oregon when Molly Moore, the governor's healthcare workforce coordinator, and I made a presentation reviewing the shortage issues, the barriers that we're facing, and most importantly, information on some of the amazing collaborations that are going on around the state. As we stated in our testimony that day, there are just multitudes of local and regional collaborations between healthcare and local educational institutions at all levels, and it's happening all around the state. And we have tried in the past to sort of catalog that. And as soon as we get a catalog done, we discover that we are missing someone. And so while we believe all of these efforts really deserve a lot of credit, we are really wanting to focus on the statewide initiatives that are providing some support to all of them around the state. So the intent of SCR 7 is to enable the legislature to acknowledge and endorse the activities that are going on a statewide basis to further the healthcare workforce, and also to help drive maybe additional projects in the local areas. And in a time of lean resources on the statewide basis, we think that your support, even without dollars, in providing a resolution such as this will go a long ways towards keeping the effort moving and encouraging people to continue their wonderful job around the state. And we would request that you pass SPR 7. Thank you.
Is there any questions, concerns? And I think you were the only ones to testify. Do you know of any opposition?
None that I'm aware of.
Okay. I'll close a public hearing on SCR 7, and I'd like to open a work session on SCR 7.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 7 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves SCR 7 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George? Mm. Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. I would like to, see. I guess I'll carry this.
Thank you.
All right, and I will close the work session on SCR 7. And we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 880. And Martin Taylor, Liz Ledoux, and Ann Barry Lieber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's great to be back with you again. Senate Bill 880 is a bill that Oregon Nurses Association and the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon have been working with Senator Montes Anderson on, and we appreciate you lending your support as the chief sponsor of this bill. Our feeling is that this piece of legislation is designed to be not so very controversial as things that we've brought to you in the past. It is largely going through the statutes, identifying places where a function has been explicitly given to a physician, and in our opinion, it's a function that is now currently within the scope of practice of a nurse practitioner. Many of the statutes that we're going to be referring to are things that were written before nurse practitioners existed. Frequently, it's simply who signs a form. So our hope is that this really reflects an update of Oregon statutes to recognize the role that current nurse practitioners currently serve and to increase access to their patients' care. To go through the bill with you, I've brought a couple of nurse practitioners that I will let introduce themselves, but I wanted to mention that in my haste to put together a good statement from ONA, I didn't fail to leave out a challenge. There's three grammatical errors in our written testimony that I let you all find. And with that, Liz?
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Ledoux, and I'm the immediate past chair of Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. As Martin had pointed out, many of these things are not changing very much, but picking up those places where nurse practitioners were probably overlooked rather than specifically excluded or meant to be excluded. And I'm going to start out with the Section 8 reference, which has to do with the permits for sterilization. My own practice until recently was as a nurse practitioner with Clackamas County, where I provided prenatal care. And the care was given by myself as a nurse practitioner and occasionally another nurse practitioner or nurse midwife, with only a physician involved about one visit a month for a few hours of an afternoon, or telephone consultations with unusual situations. But the bulk of the care was given by the nurse practitioner. By state regulations, for instance, a sterilization permit has to be signed 30 days in advance of the sterilization in the case of a publicly funded sterilization. Now, very often a pregnant woman is going to plan on having a tubal ligation as a permanent sterilizing procedure immediately post-delivery. She will not meet a physician until she actually goes into labor and is admitted to the hospital. So the all the paperwork has to be done, signed, sealed, and delivered well before that patient would have met her physician, delivering physician. Or for that matter, she might not be delivered by a physician. Going to the university, she might very well be delivered by a nurse, certified nurse midwife. So it's one of those omissions that I think was not intentional, but is extremely awkward, because this paperwork has to be done before the procedure can be done. Another one, a fairly simple one, is the signing of special health-related driving permits. That is something that the primary care provider for the individual would ordinarily be signing, but in many cases that primary care provider is a nurse practitioner rather than a physician. And there may be no physician who has any knowledge of the patient and would then require that individual get an appointment with a physician who doesn't know them, doesn't know what the health-related issue is, could be manipulated as well by someone whose health-related issue isn't a significant one. So it's kind of a housekeeping sort of a thing. One that is not listed here, but which we intend to add as an amendment, is disabled hunting and fishing licenses require signature by a physician. Again, many people are cared for entirely by nurse practitioners, and particularly in the rural parts of the state. To get a physician appointment just to get a form signed so that they can get a hunting and fishing licenses, costly, time-consuming, something could be done as a part of a regular visit with their primary provider. The Section 12 issue has to do with the referral back by an audiologist. It requires that the patient be sent to or referred back to a ENT specialist, or lacking an ENT specialist, to a primary provider in their community. In many communities, that primary provider is in fact a nurse practitioner. So we would like to see that one cleared up. Another example is the oral health exam for the denturists. and it requires that the mouth be examined by a dentist or a physician to ensure that there's appropriate oral health for the before the denturist can operate. And that, again, when the primary provider is a nurse practitioner, that would be an awkward situation. The patient would have to make a special appointment to see a physician who might be in another community when, in fact, their primary provider or nurse practitioner should be able to do that. That's all. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Ann Barry Lever. I'm a nurse practitioner and madam of the chair and committee. I have several sections that I would like to speak with you today about. I'm a nurse practitioner at Willamette University Health Center in Salem. I've practiced also with Clackamas County and also been in collaborative practice with a physician in Troutdale. And currently at the university, I see students for simple things, sore throats, mono, flu, urinary tract infections. Also, I do see students and diagnose, I'm the primary diagnoser for kidney disorders and some cancers. So it is a wide variety of practice, and many times I'm first line. And so I think it's important to remember that when we look at this bill and the language, because many cases it says physician, and in fact it does apply to nurse practitioners. I'd like to comment on some sections that deal with public health function, communicable disease prevention and control, and institutionalized patients that nurse practitioners deal with. If we look at section one, that's institutionalized mental health services, and this, in the beginning, I believe these, like we've said before, that these rules were made before the language nurse practitioner and the concept, perhaps, came along. Many of mental health state institutions that employ nurse practitioners, they are first line and they do provide direct care to the patients and make medical judgments, order lab tests, maybe MRIs, x-ray, radiology, those kinds of things. And so to update the language there, I think, would be very important. Section 3 on spread of contagious disease, this would allow, currently the language says physician, would allow nurse practitioners to issue health certificates to patients suffering from communicable disease for purpose of preventing and spreading that disease. I think that's important because nurse practitioners often know communicable disease, the impact of communicable disease, and this would also perhaps be in an institutionalized setting or a correctional facility. And as we know now, correctional facilities mostly employ nurse practitioners. They do have medical directors that are physicians. And most of the time, nurse practitioners work in close collaboration with medical directors or OHSU, oftentimes. Even though we are independent in our practice, we collaborate very closely with physicians.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the concern, I'm not sure that it's limited to institutions and communicable diseases under the purview of the county health officer, so I'm wondering how that fits. I mean clearly for somebody to be operating in the communicable disease setting independently of an overarching authority would be a concern of mine, quite simply because we need everybody needs to be tracking in the same place, and I mean there has to be a communication network, when we talked about this earlier, that's one thing that kind of popped up at me, and I'm saying, okay, does this fit in that matrix? And Madam Chair, I'm just not quite sure of that.
Okay.
Senator Cruz, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm at a little bit of a loss to answer your question because I'm not sure I can add a lot of light to it. There's actually three sections here that relate to the spread of communicable diseases. One of those sections is related specifically to the ability for a nurse practitioner to identify an individual who is a public health threat because they have a communicable disease and to do what is legally necessary to make sure that that person is taking care of the communicable disease in a way that it's less likely to spread. So it's a public health function that nurse practitioners are qualified to serve. The second is representing those same things in the legal courtroom or case. And then actually Section 6 really just says that they have the same duty that a physician does to do everything possible to prevent the spread of a communicable disease. I'm not sure that answers your question, but
Madam Chair, I'm not arguing with the intent here. I'm just wanting to make sure we don't have an unintended disconnect.
I guess all communicable disease do have to be reported to the health department, which goes to the health officer there.
I'm sure I understand that. I'm just not sure that this authority, that this new authority has that connected to it. See, I'm saying with physicians, it's a connected authority and a reporting requirement. I just wanted to make sure that the requirements translate with the authority. I'm just unsure about that, is all.
I think I understand your question a little better now and because all we're doing is adding nurse practitioner after the word physician, all of the same requirements in these sections that a physician has, a nurse practitioner would have as well.
Although with communicable disease in Section 6, it's every physician or nurse. And I cite the example of a public health department where we have communicable disease nurses that don't have physicians working with them. They are out dealing with patients who have communicable disease, like if there's a TB outbreak, etc. So basically, I read this section, and I'm not sure you're referring to this section or not, that when they're out there, they're supposed to prevent the spread of the disease. And it's a common sense thing, but no authority.
Yeah. Sure, I think what we're saying is we have an equal responsibility, that we also are charged with responsibility, as is the physician, of reporting the communicable disease, taking those measures that have to be taken when, for instance, a homeless person with tuberculosis who is not compliant. We as well as physicians, are obligated to take measures to control the spread of that disease.
I'd like to give another example. If a student comes in and let's say they have salmonella, which I diagnose them with, and they're a food handler, then I would have the authority to ask the student not to work in a food handling situation, which of course the health department and the health officer eventually may come to realize the patient has that and stop them from working. But should I have the authority right at that diagnosis and time, that would be appropriate. And the student would have to understand that I would have the authority.
No. No. Okay. No. All right. Any other? While you're there, since you were here for the prior conversation with EMTs, and your section, my section, 13, talks about nurse practitioner, and I'm wondering if we're going to have the same problem that resulted with the physician assistants.
I'm going to let Liz LeDoux ask that, but I think we're aiming at slightly different goals than the PAs.
Okay. I think that where this has become an issue is not in the interface between the EMT and the receiving institution, but rather at the point of pickup. And there have been a couple of instances, for instance, a certified nurse midwife who has called for emergency transport for a patient who is in a very acute situation, who then gives the EMT medication and orders, if this happens, do this. It's like a discharge instruction. You're taking the patient, and this is what's wrong, and this is what you need to do in the meantime till you get to the next level. And I believe that we do not have any intention of interrupting their normal interaction with their supervising physician or the emergency room team, but rather they have been hesitant in a couple of reported instances that I know of to take those initial instructions from a nurse practitioner as opposed to a physician. And in some of the more isolated communities or in a situation where a certified nurse midwife is the provider, a certified nurse midwife also being a nurse practitioner by definition, who has been caring for the patient, knows what's going on with the patient, has orders and knows what the patient is, knows what the patient should be getting, you know, in the during the course of the transport. If they were to have to refer to a physician, that means they have to find a physician, explain what's been going on. The physician doesn't know the patient, doesn't know what's been happening, and is walking in cold. It just makes it possible for the EMT to take direction from a nurse practitioner when that is the primary care provider. So it's the primary care provider. If the primary care provider was a physician, they would take the order. If it's a nurse practitioner, there have been some controversy. But once they pass that point and they're moving onward in the system, I don't think we want to interrupt what's currently in place.
Could you cite a specific example of and I think I had heard of one, but I can't recall, where you had I'm not sure if it was a midwife or not, with a pregnant woman and needed to have transfer, and there was something
It was probably something like tributyline that had to be given or maybe the patient was bleeding. I don't remember the exact instance.
I was told, but I forgot.
But if, for instance, a patient bleeding, the patient is hemorrhaging, they're being transported, but there are certain drugs that can be given in the course of the transport to help arrest that bleeding. And in any case, the EMT felt that he could not take instruction because she was not a physician. She was a certified nurse midwife. And I'm thinking also in the more isolated communities where the primary provider is a nurse practitioner, and there isn't going to be a physician that knows the patient at that, you know, when that pickup point occurs. But after that, I don't think that we have any problem with the system that's in place, with the way that the EMT communicates with their next level.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I do believe Section 13 covers the same ground as Senate Bill 698. Mm-hmm. So a fix for one would be a fix for both, I would think. But it is referring, I mean, it is covering the same ground.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, really not weighing into the bill on the previous one, not intending to do that at all. Just for clarification, a nurse practitioner is a primary care provider, and when an ambulance comes to a nurse practitioner's clinic, there's a discharge of a patient from one provider to the ambulance. From the time that ambulance is moving, they're getting their orders from the receiving facility. So if you were to transfer from one hospital to another hospital, the receiving hospital takes control of those instructions from the time the ambulance leaves. We're really just looking for nurse practitioners to have a similar ability to discharge a patient with our primary provider. The difference with PAs is PAs are not primary providers. They're working under the delegated authority of the physician. So there is a difference in these two concepts.
Well, Madam Chair, that may be true, but this is talking about relationships with EMTs, and that's the issue. So I mean, my sense is that Madam Chair, that the issues we had in 698 resolution there would probably fit into resolution here.
We'll call the people up to address that issue, too. Okay. Further comments? Questions? Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I understand what Mr. Taylor is saying about the EMT from the discharging facility being the physician in charge, but as far as... Now, what other examples would there be a conflict between an EMT and a nurse practitioner other than being discharged from that facility, which I think makes sense? Are we dealing with things that are happening, accidents, or we're not dealing with that?
I think it would be rare. I think it has been rare that there's been a conflict. Mm-hmm. It's just at probably a issue of a misunderstanding by the EMT that nurse practitioners are primary providers. And so when they pick up a patient from a physician's office or a physician's clinic, they have comfort in accepting orders for the ongoing care of that patient. but when they pick up in some very few instances, because I think there have been very few conflicts, but they don't understand that nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives who are also nurse practitioners, are the primary provider. Mm-hmm. And so it should be essentially the same when they pick up a patient from a nurse practitioner as when they pick up a patient from a physician. That's how we see it.
Well, I guess that narrows it to just that instance, but I think what we heard on the last bill was some compelling arguments on the other side also, and I agree there is some similarity there. But anyway.
Okay. Madam Chair, this isn't, Section 13 isn't talking about picking up somebody from a doctor's office and transporting them to a hospital. It's emergency situations, mm-hmm. which is wherever the emergency is. So, and that's all in there. So so I do think that it's something that needs to be addressed. I mean, you know, if we prescribe in law a relationship that puts one part of the system at risk in other ways, for example, we say that you have to use a PA or a nurse practitioner as direct contact, and that jacks up the cost of their liability coverage because of something like that. That needs to be addressed. Just make sure we aren't having undue consequences. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Andy Easton from the Oregon Medical Association.
Just wait for Randy to specify. I think I would just as an individual situation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, representing the Oregon Medical Association. The OMA believes that Senate Bill 880 would expand the scope of practice for nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists in several areas of practice. The overarching message of the bill appears to be that nurse practitioners should be permitted to perform medical services in lieu of physicians in a myriad of contexts. We believe that this continues to blur the line distinction between physicians and nurse practitioners. Any expansion of scope of practice must necessarily accompanied by corresponding minimal levels of education and training. We respectfully request that the committee set this bill aside so that we can further review the statutes that this is applying to and discuss our concerns in some agreements with Martin Taylor and the nurse the nurse practitioners and the Oregon Nurses Association.
Questions? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. One question.
Yes.
Do you mean you were not consulted before this bill was drafted?
That is correct.
Oh, goodness.
Shocking.
No, I think that they were, but that's my opinion. Okay, John Pragastis.
Oh, goodness. This is interesting.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's nice to be back in front of you 2 or 3 minutes later. Senator Cruz,
please identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is John Pragastis. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon State Paramedic Association. My address is in Portland. Senator Cruz hit the point exactly, which is we have one concern with this bill. Out of 17 pages, our only objection is this question of nurse practitioners in emergency and non-emergency care throughout the whole scope regarding ambulance service. We have heard the story of the nurse midwives and some of their problems. As I heard it, we're talking about a handful. To give you an idea of how busy we are in Portland, we're doing almost 40,000 calls a year. My experience in rural areas particularly is that when nurse midwives and the hospitals and the doctors all work together very closely, this kind of a problem doesn't occur. My understanding, as I say, is we're talking about a very small problem here. We're more than happy to work with the nurse midwives and anybody else. If what they're looking for is a small change, to allow something in online medical control, this is easily resolved. We have a hard time believing that nurses want to be regulated both by the Board of Nursing and the State Health Division, who controls ambulances, and the Board of Medical Examiners, which handles our scope of practice. It just is all over the board. And if there's a way that we can work with them, I've spoken with one of the women that just testified, there's a way here. But I'm afraid that this way is one that we're opposed to. So we enjoy a good relationship with the nurses, always have, and would like to work with them some more.
Great. Because the ultimate goal is to make sure that the patient is taken care of.
Absolutely.
And so with the focus on that, I think, you know, if amendments or whatever can happen, that's great. Same with the Oregon Medical Association. Senator George.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Gary McLean's testimony that we have right before us right now.
Yes, sir.
Gary makes an interesting point that worries me. This is a tactical operation in which time is of the essence for an EMT to get out there, secure this patient, get them to deliver to a facility where the proper care will be administered or continued care. He makes a statement that the nurse practitioner would become the third type of EMT medical supervisor. And to me, that's compounding a problem as far as chain of command and quick response.
This is exactly right, sir. Gary is my boss, and for the record, is also a registered nurse here in Oregon besides a standing paramedic. Our concern is that between this bill and the last bill we spoke of, we're now creating these different categories, and that's going to split the system. In 30-something years, I've not heard that this question needed to be addressed. And so I'm surprised today to hear that this is a real problem that requires immediate attention. If there are very specific circumstances, we would like to work with them. We're committed to patients. They're our lifeblood, and we love them. And so anything we can do to improve patient care here in the state is where we'd like to be. Does that answer your question, sir?
Just do a quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. What I think he says here, and says clearly, is that this may just be muddying the water rather than clarifying authority. You know, because you now have three types of EMT medical supervisors. Which one do I respond to? Who really is in charge of this decision-making process? And do you see that as a potential? I mean, I know you don't want to argue with the boss here.
Oh, no, we agree. And we do see that as exactly the problem. We also see the possibility of variations within the EMS system where you have different levels of training and authority and, as you mentioned, insurance and all the ancillaries. Mm-hmm. We in the field in the middle of the night are going to get caught with something that goes one way this way. We're speaking with somebody different from another time within the same shift. We would like to see the regular chain of command in the ambulance arena carried the same way as is now. We just don't see that there's a problem.
Just a quick follow-up. You have on staff an EMT-trained physician who's going to be the supervisor. Now,
yes.
If we add one or two more, who has the ultimate authority? Should that be clarified in law?
Well,
because there may be a conflict, and somebody has to say, no, this is it. Take them here.
Senator, between the State Health Division's Emergency Medical Services OARs, that is clearly done. In the Board of Medical Examiners, OARs, our scope of medical care and standing orders, is clearly defined. The relationship between an ambulance company and their supervising physician, their further designees, are all very clear to us and in place. We see a definite problem, as you mentioned, with these multiple chains of authority. And when on a scene, at a call in the future, at different facilities that we transfer to, in and out of various counties, We've run calls to Boise from Portland. We go everywhere, as do most of the rural services come towards the major facilities. We just see this as being all over the board. And because it spells out all care, all emergency care, all non-emergency care, the potential is that this grows and grows and grows and becomes a problem.
Thank you. Senator Morrison.
Thank you. Well, just an observation. I'm kind of amused by the turf battles that occur, and I spent 2 hours yesterday in Eugene meeting with Martin Taylor and the nurses, and I think we resolved some issues, and I really appreciate the fact that they were willing to discuss the issues. Now, I say I have to go back to my original statement. I'm amused, but I'm also... I had a nurse practitioner as my primary care physician for almost 3 years. Actually, the doctor that I signed up for, I never saw. I saw the, and I got, I became very comfortable working with the nurse practitioner, and I felt that she was extremely qualified to do many, many things. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a good idea to pull things out, but I think you ought to talk to the doctor while you're in the process of pulling scopes of practice out. To me, it makes sense that the emergency doctor would be the primary authority in terms of the EMTs. It just, you know, the emergency technicians are an extension of the emergency room. And I think, and I agree with Senator Cruz, that it kind of muddies the water and makes it difficult, not better, but more difficult. But we have a shortage of healthcare providers in rural areas, and so we have to maximize those people that we have. And so that's the need, I guess, to extend the scope of practice, and I think that's reasonable. But there are times when we have to, I guess, be even more reasonable about doing that.
Senator, right now in the state of Oregon, there are almost 200 certified physicians that operate within the ambulance arena. There are even more designees behind that. We acknowledge that, particularly in the rural areas, healthcare is becoming a problem. When it comes to ambulance service, though, we're talking about someone with a specific need right at the time. We're not talking about enlarging a clinic for more patient care. The statute now requires counties to plan for ambulance services and see that sufficient ambulance service is provided within the counties. So I appreciate your comment. I think maybe we're talking about different topics. But I think that your comment about rural health care is very important.
Thank you. Sean Baird?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sean Baird, Legislative Chair for Oregon State Ambulance Association. I just wanted to real quickly touch on the specific examples that the nurse practitioners that were up here cited with the certified nurse midwives and some catastrophic complications that happen when a nurse midwife may be attending a delivery and they need something to happen or would like to see something happen in the ambulance on the way to the receiving hospital. One of the nice things about the way the system is set up as it is right now is, and I've had this happen in the Woodburn area frequently, we'll have a local, in my case it's been physicians, but certainly a certified nurse midwife would have the same access. If the EMTs or paramedics are not carrying the medications that they would like to see them carry in the event of, say, I think what they were talking about was postpartum hemorrhage or some other significant complications of delivery, they can come to the whoever the ambulance provider is in that area and say, geez, you guys, you really need to be carrying oxytocin or tributyline or whatever it may be, and work with their supervising physician to get a standing order in place so that in the event that there are those kind of situations that come up again wherever, if there's a community where a nurse midwife is the OB practitioner out there, I think it'd be great if they worked with their local service to ensure that the standing orders were in place to deal with all those situations. And that can all be done on a very local level without having to involve y'all.
What I would like to see, that's the last of the testimony, I would really like the Oregon Medical Association as well as the paramedics, emergency response teams, to work with Martin Taylor regarding the specific issues they simply can't live with in this bill and work on a compromise. That because the ultimate goal is the patient, and we want to make sure that patient delivery is not impeded because of not wanting to take an order, and so that's the main goal. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 880, and is that all we have? Meeting adjourned.